Chapter 12. The High Nine. He was walking perfectly within a day, and because I'd managed to cover his most egregious parts with the old sack, it wasn't such a chore to stay at his side. You don't think of these things when you deal with normal men. Or women, I suppose, if that's who you are. Think on it a moment. If you were deposited somewhere with another member of your own sex, both of you as naked as the day you were born, it might be uncomfortable, but you could sort yourself out in a hurry. You spend more time trying to work out your situation than you do worrying about the, situation, as it were. So you and your imaginary naked friend can walk from place to place, communicate, and work together without too much trouble. You can keep your eyes dead ahead, or at least averted. No one has to worry about being labeled a cockpeeper. Now, consider the same situation. Only the naked guy is twice your size. Even walking abreast, that big damned hunk of meat is right there, swinging out in the open like the proudest son of a bitch in history, and it's right on the level with your jaw. Walk a little behind, and you're choking down a face full of ass. Move a pace ahead, and you have to worry about being concussed by an errant swing from a flapping bludgeon. Look, I know this probably sounds like one of the basest concerns you've ever encountered, beneath the notice of all but the most indecent. Well, to that I say this. Try it sometime. Go get naked with the biggest son of a bitch you can find, and then spend all day trying not to eyeball a cock that seems intent on invading your space like an over-friendly, overstuffed sausage. It's probably the worst thing you could ever do. Yes, it was a relief having his loins wrapped up. I tore another strip from the hem of my shirt, which was nearly a total loss anyway, and used it to cinch the ends of the sack at his hip. Luckily, I even had enough left over to split into wrappings. I used these to cover the backs of my hands. I still didn't know what the golden diamonds were for, or why I had them. But I had a feeling they were something that ought to be hidden, just like my new friend's killer battering ram. I imagined waking up to Nyx standing over me in the dark, trying to pry them from the skin with a rusty old dagger, apologizing the entire time the way he always did. It took the rest of the day for us to walk to my hut, given that Risa was still getting his legs under him. He moved wonderfully toward the end, but it required much practice for him to attain the skill. And of course, I walked close by his side because I was afraid something would spook him into running off in some direction. I had no hope of outrunning or catching him at all. I didn't realize how fast he could truly move when I met him, and it would be some time before I learned. But I knew he could scramble on his hands and knees faster than I could sprint on 2 feet. Later, much later, I saw him outrun a chariot on the battlefield without really trying. But this was still the early days of our friendship. The silence began to bother me again as I followed the road. It made me tense. When it was just me or Ambrosius, I would sometimes sing to pass the time. My voice is about as melodious as a sack of abused badgers, but when you're alone on the road, you don't care. Having Risa along made me self-conscious, though. Also, I didn't want him listening to me and thinking that was the proper way to do it. I thought of him, I suppose, the way a new parent thinks of his babe. I didn't want to retard the poor chap with my own substandard abilities. I talked to help the time pass by. I started at first by discussing myself, but lost interest in the subject pretty fast. After a while, I realized it didn't matter so much what I said as opposed to how I said it. I could ask him questions, and he would respond in his own way, sometimes in a grunt, and others attempting to repeat my own words back to me. He seemed to enjoy the interaction, so I kept it up. You know, I was commanded to find you by the goddess Ing. She said she is your mother. Were you aware? He grunted. Your mother, yes indeed. Can you remember her? Do you have any recollection beyond coming awake this morning? No answer that time. Well, since you seem not to remember her, I will tell you some things about your mother. These are things you should like to know, I think. I think everyone would like to know certain things about their mothers. What they look like, what is or was important to them, if they were good or bad people, and so on. We don't all get to learn these things. Many of us go our whole lives never knowing these things, and so we must make up a history for our parents so that we do not go insane as children. I will not let this happen to you. I will tell you about your mother. Her name is Ing, and she is the great mother of all Erda. She is of the land, of the soil, and of fertility. All creatures who crawl, walk, swim, or fly belong to her. All of the plants that root in the soil and stretch toward Sunna's throne are her handiwork. She is a goddess, one of the High Nine. And she is your mother, Risa, claimed by her very words, proclaimed to me in person. How about that? He nodded slowly. I wish I could tell you what she's like, but I didn't speak with her long enough to understand. I felt very strange in her presence, very uncomfortable. I will tell you this now, and please don't hold it against me that I say so. She is the most beautiful woman I've ever encountered or will ever encounter. I am finished trying to find the perfect woman. I could search until the end of time, beyond the lives of thousands of men, beyond the life of Erda herself, and still, I would never find your mother's equal, Risa. Believe that. Even so, I did not want her as a man wants a woman. I do not remember what it was like to have a mother. Not really. But maybe what I felt in looking at her is what a normal child feels in looking at his own mother, assuming she is kind and loves him. Maybe if you meet her someday, you can explain it to me. I will try not to describe her face to you. I don't have the words. My best attempt would be a profanity. But I will give you characteristics to help guide you, hoping that one day you'll find her. You must be able to recognize her. First, I took up his hand and held mine next to it. Look at your hands, Risa. This is what the skin of every man, woman, and child in Erda looks like. You see the color? White is what we call it. Look, let me see. Where can I spot some more white in these thrice-damned woods? I looked about for a bit and eventually spotted a thick strand of birch trees a little deeper in. I told Ambrosius to wait for us on the path, which he glibly ignored, and led Risa over to them. I put a hand on a trunk and said, "White. See, Risa? White." I tapped the back of my hand and repeated, "White." Then I pointed at the skin of his forearm, which was so pale that the veins stood out in blue beneath the surface, and said it again. "White. Understand?" He pointed at his hand, and then at the birch trees. "Why?" "That's good, Risa. White." I scuffed a hole through the ground cover with my heel and dug up a handful of soil. "Now look at this. This is black. White and black. This is like the skin of your mother, Risa. It is like the skin of Ing, I suspect, perhaps because she is made of the soil, and the soil is made of her. There is no one else in all of Erda like her. Do you see?"
"See."
"Good. Very good. The most beautiful woman I've ever seen, that anyone's ever seen, as alien and terrible as the Dwergas, who she also calls her children. The kindest woman I think I've ever met. She was very kind to me, Risa. Kind when she needn't be. She is a god, and I'm only a stupid and brutal coward. She had no reason to be good to me, really, but she was. And I'm still trying to understand it. I've done many things, many shameful things that are an affront to her and her works. And yet she laughed with me and put me at ease. This is a being of great charity. Remember these things, Risa. Remember all of them. These are the things from which you descend. And though I may be a steaming hunk of shit, you can at least attain to something greater. Your mother is Ing, the great mother of Erda. Do you understand? Say her name. Say the name Ing.
Ing.
That's good. And now, as we've discussed your mother, the natural path would be to discuss your father, a topic I know nothing about. It's another important lesson, I think. Fathers fuck whomever they choose, and it is very easy for them to go away when they do. Mothers do not have it so easy. I don't know what that means, either for the mother, for the father, or the child's relationship to them. It may be important, though, so I mention it in passing. Because I do not know your father, I will tell you of the father of Erda, Godan. He is the chieftain god, the first among the nine. He possesses much wisdom, and is the inventor of our language, which he apparently gifted to the first peoples of Erda in the form of sacred tablets. I say apparently here, because I don't know that anyone has actually seen these tablets, but every priest of Godan you'll ever speak to swears the damned things exist. Now, having met you, and especially your mother, I suppose I'm more likely to believe. But really, I suspect language came to us like everything else. It was just something we fucked around with from generation to generation until it started to make sense. Now, where was I going? Right, the father of Erda. This is where it gets juicy, Risa, so pay attention. Frigg is the wife of Godan, you see. But Ing is the mother of Erda, the Verm. I suppose you see what I'm getting at, not wishing to besmirch your mother's honor. I did say she was stunning, didn't I? If the stories are be to believed, Godan found her irresistible, which I guess is fine because Frigg isn't really known for her constancy. Thunair, the Lord of the Sky, is said to be the son of Godan and Frigg, but I have heard various priests disagree on the matter, sometimes violently. It seems certain sects hold that Thunair is the offspring of Frigg and an ancient human king, now long forgotten to time. But then, if he's forgotten, you have to ask how the priests know this to be true. I don't spend much effort pondering these mysteries myself. Now you have Hel, the daughter of Thunair. As with the others, her mother is disputed by different sects. Within some, Frigg is the mother, making for a rather unfortunate relationship between mother and son. Others have it that he fathered her on Zinkund, who I will discuss in a moment. And finally, I heard even of an offshoot sect of the followers of Godan that Erda herself is the mother of Hel. Which would mean, That would mean that Thunair lay with his half-sister, in which case his daughter is also his niece. Or with his mother, in which case his daughter is also his sister. I think that's right. Look, don't put a lot of thought into it, okay? These are all the arguments of stupid men. If you want to know the truth, it's probably best to consult the god. But the main point is that Hel is the goddess of death, who shepherds the fallen to the world beyond. She is a tragic figure. Most fear her only because they fear to die, and yet every story they tell says she is gentle and loving, and that she guides us through the outer chaos with her love. Thus are the principal gods, Godan, Frigg, Ing, Thunair, and Hel, accounted for. Godan the chieftain, Frigg, who is of fire, Ing, the mother of the world, and Thunair, who gives us the air we breathe. Finally, Hel, who guides us all through the darkness beyond this life. And Erda, our world, is the great Verm inside of which we all live, forever within her belly as she flies through chaos, and Godan rides upon her back. Now there are the lesser gods, the most important of whom are the twins. Sunna the brother and Zintgunt the sister. They share the throne of Erda, which is at the center of the Verm's heart, far south of here. You can't see it now, but just wait. Once we come out of this tree cover, I'll take you up to the top of a hill somewhere so you can see it. The heart is the source of our light and warmth. All life in Erda strives toward it instinctively, be it plant or animal. And you can see that it is anchored within Erda by the vast heartstrings that bind it to the cavern. When the brother Sunna sits upon the throne, the light he gives is powerful like fire. It burns golden in the sky and brings us warmth. Zintgunt is not as strong as her brother, but what she lacks in power she makes up for in beauty. Her light is cold, but shines like bright silver. There is nothing like her light anywhere else in all the world. Any poet or minstrel who was ever worth a shit has dedicated at least one composition to her, and no matter how skillful they might be, the song is a sad failure when weighed against her. Finally, there are the remaining two of the High Nine. Seeksneet, the god of vengeance, and Tyr, the god of war. These are the gods you only hear about when people need something. If a man is bitter, he might sacrifice to Seeksneet for the death of his enemies, for example. Or, if he goes off to war, he might pray to Tyr to guide his weapon on the field of battle. I suppose these are valid concerns, speaking from the viewpoint of a man. But personally, I see Tyr as being the least of the nine, mostly because we humans are just so damned good at killing each other without his help. Maybe I'm saying something dangerous, I don't know. But I've said it before, and he's never skinned me alive, so maybe he agrees, or simply does not care. It seems a god shouldn't care what a human has to say, doesn't it? One would hope they have more important things to think about. Now, of course, there are plenty of lesser gods as well, but I have given to you the greatest among them. You can get away with being ignorant in regard to the lower ranks, but you don't want to show ignorance of the High Nine. They'll behead you in most places if you deny their existence, for example, places like the larger cities in the south. Regarding the lesser gods, well, you see new cults spring up from time to time. I've heard there's a new sect in Schwerin that's become convinced the Dwergas have a king and have since begun to demand his inclusion in the Pantheon, but I don't think they're making much progress. They've not denied the High Nine, though, and so they're allowed to live. I'd run out of things to say. I was tired of talking and wanted to rest my mouth. The light had begun to fail, but I could tell we were close to home by the shape of the road and by familiar trees that we passed. I concentrated on the path, kicking large rocks away when I noticed them to protect Reese's feet. I wondered how he was getting along, having walked several miles in barefoot, yet he hadn't complained once throughout the day. Maybe he didn't know how to complain, though. Maybe his feet were hurting. Maybe all of him was in constant pain, but he didn't have any understanding of what was happening to him. Maybe it didn't occur to him to groan because he'd never seen anyone else do it before. I watched him carefully, searching for signs of limping or hobbling, but saw nothing. I saw so much of nothing, in fact, that I stumbled over a rock while I stared. He laughed at this, which surprised me. And then the old donkey rolled an eye back and smiled too. "All right, shitheads, very funny," I said. I led Ambrosius into his pen first when we arrived. He seemed to have had a trying day. He clomped through the gate slowly and pitched over into the straw as if he lacked the energy to do anything further. Then I latched the gate and helped Reza through the door to my home. It took a few tries for him to understand the need to crawl under the doorframe. When we were inside together, I got a little worried because the big oaf took up so much of the inside's insides. There was only my bed, the table, and the chair. The bed was barely big enough for me, and I imagined Risa trying to stretch out on the straw mattress. I thought about giving him the floor, but he was so huge. I have no idea what he weighs, but it has to be something like 3 or 4 times more than the largest normal man I'd ever seen. That weight would drive his bones and muscles into the hard-packed dirt floor. It would be torture. Then I thought of putting him outside in the straw with Ambrosius, but I didn't want anyone from the village to see him yet. I had not determined how I wanted to handle his introduction. I obviously gave him my bed. At first I tried to sit in the chair and pillow my head upon my arms crossed over the table, which wasn't as bad as you'd think. I'd slept that way several times before, so I was pretty used to it. What I was not used to, sadly, was the snoring of a giant. So a few moments later, I was back in the pen with Ambrosius. I stretched out beside him in the straw and rested my head up against his ribs. Listening to the steady beat of that old donkey's heart and the rumble of snores crashing through the wall, I slept. I suppose I'll mention here that the sleep was lousy. I was plenty comfortable. Ambrosius put off a lot of heat, and there wasn't much chill in the air either. But I had some dreams that night. Dreams like I'd never had before. I've forgotten most of them now, and yet enough linger on that I recall sitting again within Sunna's throne, watching Erda all around me, beneath me, above me, watching it all as it spun around and around. I could feel the power under me, within the seat, and felt it radiating through me, and before long, I found I could feel it running through the heartstrings, down into Erda's skin, where it branched out through an infinite tracery of arteries like blood lightning. And I sensed that behind me in the throne was a doorway that could be opened only from the other side. I heard many voices creeping through. There was nothing to eat. The last time I'd eaten was on the bank of the Ruhr, and I had no idea when Risa had eaten last. I remembered him responding to my food pantomime from the day before, and figured that if he was hungry then, he must have been ravenous that morning. Thinking about it now, I wonder if he'd ever actually eaten before I met him. I dug up every secret hiding place that I could think of in my home, while Risa compressed himself into a corner, watching me quietly. I found a few bits, but it was only enough for a hunk of bread and some watered wine, nowhere near enough to feed a giant. It was hard for me to dream up a plan. I was very worried. I had been worried about our food the previous night, walking him home with me and wondering how an Erda I was going to care for him. I tried to understand my own thinking, and failed. I couldn't understand why I led him to my house. It was senseless. I didn't have the means to care for a giant. I didn't even have the means to clothe him. Anyone with a hint of intelligence would have just left him out there on the mountain. They would have slipped by silently as he rooted around in the dirt, always under cover, until they were far away in the trees. And then they would have run. But Ing had commanded, and I heard her. "You stay here," I eventually told him. I pointed at his chest. "You," then at the floor. "Stay here." We nodded at each other, and I left. I took the road south to the village, passing Ambrosius, who still slept the morning away in his pen. I would head to town, case out one of the farms, and steal some potatoes. There was nothing like a potato to fill the belly. I'd pack a load of them into my shirt if I had to, bring them home, and boil them soft. It would take care of the near term, buy me a little time to figure out something better. I had to be careful, though, stealing from my neighbors like that. They only tolerated my presence around that village. If they knew I was stealing, they'd run me out. They might even paint me in pitch before sending me down the road. I'd seen a man so treated in Colmar once when I was a boy. After the stuff had cooled, some of us kids had tried to peel it off his back, but he only screamed like we were killing him. The stuff had become hard, like a long black scab, and when we dug our fingers under the edges and pulled, his skin started to come away with it, leaving a wet, red openness behind. We thought the man was passing out when we started, but as soon as we lifted that edge away from his back, he began to buck around on the cobbles and scream as if we were killing him, which maybe we were. He made us angry, screaming like that. Here we were, trying to help the idiot, and at every turn he screamed like we were the ones who'd put him in that state. One of the larger boys, Apex, hit him in the head to silence him, but Apex lacked the strength to put him out. Then I tried kicking him in the face as hard as I could, but I wasn't strong enough either. He just carried on and stirred up a racket until we stopped. We stood there staring at this man, trying to figure out how to get the pitch off him, angry that he wouldn't shut the fuck up, angry that the pitch had covered his clothes so thoroughly that there was no way for us to get at his purse. Angry that his purse was probably empty. He finally quieted down, maybe just passed out, and we amused ourselves a while by stacking bits of trash on his body as if he was a castle, and then we played around him a while, having pretend battles with little warriors and little knights and the castle we'd made. At dusk, we returned to our evening hiding places. I'd escaped the forge by this time. In the morning, we returned to play with our castle some more, but it had died sometime during the evening. We found it laying in a pool of its own vomit, and we could smell that it had shat itself in death. Then we went away. I didn't want to be a castle. I couldn't keep robbing farmers. I would be caught eventually. I needed to get some tools together as fast as I could and start building up again. I had to get out ahead of that giant stomach. I didn't know if I could, honestly, but I considered that I now had the strength of a giant at my disposal. I really had no idea how much or how little something like that might help, but it sure had to be better than a flatulent donkey. I decided those were problems for later. For now, the main problem was putting myself back in business. I composed a list of critical items as I walked along. I would have to limit myself to bare essentials at first. I wouldn't be able to afford a new cart. That was the thing that hurt the most. The Dwergaz had seen to mine, and the damned thing had made me very effective. I could stay out for days just loading it up, bring back a massive haul, and make my money in volume. Carrying it all by hand would slow me down to a crawl, maybe so much that I might spend money faster than I could make it, just keeping the three of us, Risa, myself, and Ambrosius, alive. I might be able to have it repaired, but that meant I'd have to find some way to get it back to Anderlin's. I might need to hire a large wagon to bring it back for me, which was yet more money I didn't have. I would just have to leave it out there then, and hope it was still there when I had the money to repair it. We would have to get by on baskets in the meantime. Most wives in the village could weave in one form or another, and some of them could weave the most powerful baskets you've ever seen. They could make baskets that were longer than a man, and yet didn't get in the way of your legs when you slung them onto your back and walked. They positioned the shoulder straps so that the top of the basket climbed high over your head, but somehow knew how to balance it so that you did not feel unsteady moving under a load. The baskets spread the weight out over your whole body so that there was no single part of you that was tired first. All of you got tired at the same time, slowly and evenly, so that you could travel for a very long distance, longer than you would have first thought. They were quite marvelous, and what was more, they didn't cost as much as a cart. They didn't even cost as much as a pick, and some of those wives were so damn good at what they did that they could turn out a basket in just a few hours if the materials were handy. I thought I'd have a few of these made, one for me, and a set to sling over Ambrosius's back, and a huge one for Risa to wear. I thought I might be able to replace the lost capacity of my cart in this way, and once I'd convinced myself that this was so, I started to feel better. A pick, a shovel, and a few baskets felt attainable to me. If I could scrape a little credit together, these things were attainable. They felt possible. My whole life had consisted of dividing what I wanted from what was possible, and in nearly all cases I'd found that I could live on what was possible. It was not comfortable, but it was possible. Life would not be easy, but it would be possible. I could live on possible. I'd been living on possible my whole goddamned life. I began to hear sounds as I walked. The first buildings of the village came into view, and the sounds grew louder. I heard cheering, shouts, screams, bellows. I heard the sounds of metal ringing on metal, of laughter, the sounds of drinking, laughing men and of women squealing happily, of women laughing in the way they do so that men will take a look at them, they hope, and think about them when they shouldn't, as they shouldn't. The way women laugh so that men will think of their dresses, what they'll find under the dresses, the way they laugh. The way women laugh so that they can dive into your mind and make you think of them when you don't want to, so that your cock stiffens, and they smile to think of it, and they laugh at you to think of it. They bury the image in your mind with the sound of their laughter, and they smile at you, and they know. They know what they've done. And I smiled, walking along as I heard that laughter, because Ing had touched me. Not my body, but within my mind somehow. Scoured me. So that the me inside felt different. Felt unlike me. I felt unlike me. And that laughter could no longer find the path to my heart, to my belly, to my balls. I smiled before I began to cry.